This program is provided by lawyer Kyung-jin Kim.
Usually, you know, a robust, deeply savory stew demands like hours of browning meat.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you're roasting root vegetables, simmering heavy bones, just to extract every possible drop of flavor.
Right, it's a whole weekend project for a home cook.
Exactly. But today, we are diving into a Korean stew, Jeonggeut Jjeonjjigae, that achieves this this heavyweight knockout flavor profile in just 40 minutes.
Which is wild.
It is. And get this, no beef, no pork, no seafood. Just the water, vegetables, and, well, a whole lot of bacterial magic.
It completely inverts the standard culinary physics you learn in Western cooking. I mean, thyme and heavy animal proteins are usually the non-negotiable currency, right?
Right. You have to pay that toll.
You do. You have to pay it to get that kind of robust depth. So finding a culinary tradition that just bypasses that entirely by using rapid fermentation to achieve the same savory resonance, that's a massive paradigm shift.
And that is the exact mission for today's deep dive. We're taking a really close look at the culinary notes and research surrounding this specific dish because we want to extract the ultimate practical guide for you to make it at home wherever you are. So we're skipping the internet folklore, skipping the medical probiotic claims.
Sticking to the facts.
Yes, focusing strictly on the culinary mechanics. We want to understand how this meatless, highly efficient stew actually functions in the kitchen.
The defining characteristic of this dish, like the entire blueprint for what you are trying to achieve, is actually hiding in plain sight within the research notes.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, because while the English translations often just call it a fermented soybean stew.
Which sounds a bit clinical, honestly.
It does. It sounds very dry. But the Spanish translation provided in the notes captures the essence perfectly. It calls it guiso de soja fermentada fuerte.
Okay, let's unpack this. That last word, fuerte, meaning strong.
Right.
That one adjective tells you everything you need to know about the sensory experience you are about to create in your kitchen.
It's unapologetic.
Completely. It is intensely aromatic. I mean, when you open a container of authentic Jeonggeutjang paste, you are instantly hit with this deeply earthy, funky scent.
It has the unmistakable pungent aroma of active bacterial fermentation.
And honestly, the olfactory experience is often the biggest hurdle for uninitiated cooks.
Oh, for sure. The aroma is highly volatile. It fills your kitchen immediately.
Yeah.
But chemically speaking, that pungent aroma is simply the promise of complex umami. The volatile compounds hitting your nose are just the byproducts of amino acids that have been liberated from the soybean's protein structures.
It reminds me of how we treat, like, pungent blue cheeses in Western kitchens. Think of a remarkably ripe Roquefort.
That is a great analogy.
All right, because if you just smell the cheese in isolation, it can be intimidating. You might even hesitate to eat it.
You'd step back for a second.
Yeah, but the moment you melt that Roquefort into a cream sauce or a compound butter, the aggressive funk just transforms.
It stops being a challenge.
Exactly, and it becomes this foundational, savory depth.
Yeah.
That makes the dish impossible to stop eating.
The thermal transformation is key there. Heat volatilizes some of the harsher aromatic compounds.
So it mellows out the initial punch.
Right, while simultaneously dissolving those free amino acids into your broth. The funk mellows into richness. If the paste didn't have that aggressive fuerte aroma in its raw state, the final stew would taste, well, incredibly flat.
Just one-dimensional.
Exactly.
But I struggle with this mild requirement in the notes.
Okay, how so?
Well, we're talking about a fiercely robust, funky ingredient. And in almost every other Korean stew I make, like a classic kimchi jjigae, a heavy dose of chili spice is the backbone, right? It cuts through the richness.
Mm-hmm.
So if we pull the aggressive spice out here as the recipe strictly mandates, doesn't the dish risk becoming overwhelmingly heavy or cloying?
What's fascinating here is that the lack of fiery spice is a highly intentional architectural choice. Yeah. Think of capsaicin heat as a blazing trumpet in an orchestra. If that trumpet is playing at full volume, it is going to completely drown out the nuanced, woody resonance of a cello.
Ah, so the chili heat would just blow out your palate.
Right. And you'd miss the fermented complexity completely. Jeonggeutjang possesses a highly complex flavor matrix. It's nutty, it's earthy, slightly sweet, and profoundly savory.
Wow.
If you were to crank up the spice to the levels you see in a kimchi jjigae, you would mask all those subtle bass note frequencies. By keeping the spice deliberately mild, the fermented soybean remains the undisputed focal point of the dish.
It essentially forces you to taste the fermentation itself.
Exactly, rather than hiding it behind a wall of heat.
So the strong descriptor isn't about pain or heat at all. It's about gravitational pull.
I like that.
It's a heavy anchoring base note, which I guess brings us to the actual mechanics of cooking it.
Right, the fun part.
Because once you understand that you are building a heavy base note stew, the timeline in the research notes becomes incredibly confusing.
The 40-minute paradox.
Yes. The notes explicitly list the expected cooking time at about 40 minutes, rating the process as just medium difficulty.
Right.
And again, this is entirely vegetarian. No pork, no beef, no anchovy broth. Usually, you know, coaxing a deeply satisfying heavyweight broth out of just water and vegetables requires hours of slow reduction.
You're sweating onions, caramelizing carrots, reducing stalks.
How does this recipe manage to cheat time so effectively?
Well, the flavor development didn't happen in the 40 minutes you spent at the stove.
Okay.
It happened over several days in a warm fermentation environment. The traditional method for making cheonggujang involves boiling soybeans and then exposing them to a very specific bacteria, Bacillus subtilis.
And traditionally, this came from rice straw, right?
Exactly, which naturally harbors the bacteria.
So the bacteria is acting as the chef before you even start cooking.
That's a perfect way to put it. It is performing the exact same chemical function that a 3-hour simmer performs on a tough cut of beef. When you slow cook meat, thermal energy slowly breaks down complex proteins and collagen into simpler, highly flavorful amino acids like glutamic acid.
And that takes hours.
Right. But Bacillus subtilis does this enzymatically. It pre-digests the complex soy proteins, fracturing them into those same savory amino acids at an astonishing rate.
So you are literally buying time in a jar.
Yes.
The paste is pre-simmered, chemically speaking. The microbes did the low and slow extraction for you.
Therefore, the 40 minutes of active cooking isn't an extraction phase at all. In fact, if you try to extract flavor from cheonggujang by boiling it for 3 hours, you will ruin it.
Because you'd boil off all those delicate, volatile aromatics we talked about earlier.
You would boil off the aromatics, and you would completely destroy the structural integrity of the stew. The 40 minutes is strictly an integration phase.
Just bringing it all together.
Exactly. It's the exact amount of time required to hydrate your tofu, soften your radishes, and allow the starches from your zucchini or potatoes to slightly thicken the broth. The moment the vegetables are spoon tender, the stew is finished.
It is incredibly efficient. You drop the chunky fermented paste into the hot liquid. It instantly blooms and releases all those pre-built umami compounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then your tofu and vegetables just act as sponges, soaking up that rich broth.
It highlights a completely different culinary philosophy.
How so?
Well, instead of forcing flavor out of ingredients through brute thermal force, you are setting the stage and letting the microbial enzymes do the heavy lifting beforehand.
I mean, cooking this outside of Seoul brings up a massive practical issue, though.
Oh, absolutely. The ingredient sourcing.
Right, because if you just grab, you know, any fermented paste off an international supermarket shelf.
Assuming they all work the same way.
Exactly. If you assume they function identically, you are going to fundamentally ruin the dish.
Navigating the ingredient substitutions is where most overseas cooks stumble, primarily because they misunderstand the difference between various Asian fermented soy products.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If a cook can't find authentic cheonggujang, the temptation is to reach for a tub of Japanese miso or even a long fermented Korean doenjang.
Right, they think fermented soy paste is fermented soy paste.
Yeah, but replacing cheonggujang with like a smooth white miso doesn't just alter the flavor. It destroys the entire physical architecture of the stew.
It erases the rustic identity of the dish entirely. Doenjang and miso are generally fermented for much longer periods, often months or years.
Right.
And they are typically pureed or mashed into a relatively uniform paste. Cheonggujang is a rapid fermentation, often just a few days. And crucially, it uses the whole soybean.
It's chunky. It has bite.
Yes. The mouthfeel is entirely different. You are meant to chew the beans along with the tofu.
So the physical beans act as textural anchors in the broth.
Exactly. If you substitute a delicate, perfectly smooth paste, you are no longer making cheonggujang jjigae. You are making a thin, polite miso soup.
The broth loses its viscosity.
It loses its viscosity, and the eating experience loses its rustic, hearty nature. You have to respect the fuerte profile, both in flavor and in texture.
So if a listener is forced to substitute, they really need to hunt down the darkest, chunkiest traditional soybean paste they can find.
Absolutely.
I've actually seen some ingenious cooks mix a robust, dark red miso with a package as Japanese natto.
Oh, that's clutter.
Right. Since natto is also fermented whole soybeans, utilizing a very similar bacillus strain, it sort of approximates that sticky, funky texture and brings those whole beans back into the matrix of the stew.
That is an excellent mechanical workaround. It restores the physical presence of the bean and introduces a comparable enzymatic funk that a standard miso lacks.
There is another massive practical reality hiding in the research notes, and honestly, it is a bit of a culinary blind spot.
Uh-oh, what is it?
Under the section listing allergies to check for this recipe, the notes explicitly state, not specified, which is wildly ironic.
A glaring omission, considering the foundational ingredient.
Right. We're talking about a stew where the broth, the primary flavoring agent, and often the main protein inclusion, you know, the tofu.
They're all derived from the exact same plant.
Yes. Soy is the giant unspoken allergen in the room. If anyone at your table has a soy allergy, this dish is fundamentally off limits.
It really underscores the necessity of remaining vigilant and applying common sense, regardless of what a recipe card omits.
Definitely.
And this raises an important question about hidden ingredients, particularly for those trying to maintain the vegetarian nature of the dish while using substitute ingredients abroad.
Because commercial substitutes often take shortcuts to achieve that deep umami.
They do. Authentic, artisan Qianggezhang relies purely on bacterial fermentation for its savory depth. It requires no animal products whatsoever.
Okay.
But commercial paste or pre-made soup bases found in overseas markets frequently cheat. To mimic that deep savory resonance quickly and cheaply, manufacturers will often blend bonito extract, which is dried fish, or beef extract directly into the paste.
Wow. So an overseas listener trying to make a hearty vegetarian meal might grab a tub of commercial soybean paste, assume it's just beans and salt, and inadvertently introduce meat or seafood into the pot.
You must aggressively check the ingredient labels. Words like flavor enhancer, bonito, dashi, or beef stock powder sneak into commercial pastes with surprising frequency.
That's a trap.
It is. If you are cooking for a strict vegetarian or someone with a severe shellfish or fish allergy, assuming a soy paste is purely plant-based can lead to a significant culinary error.
It is fascinating how a dish so seemingly simple, you know, just water, vegetables, and a fermented paste, requires such a precise understanding of mechanics and ingredient sourcing to execute correctly.
It really does.
So what does this all mean? When we zoom out from the boiling pot and look at the broader culinary landscape, What does Qianggezhang Jjigae teach us about Korean food culture?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this specific stew acts as a brilliant counter-narrative to the dominant stereotype surrounding Korean cuisine globally.
You mean the perception that Korean food is exclusively about sizzling pork belly on a grill and aggressively spicy, bright red sauces?
Precisely. The global proliferation of Korean BBQ and those viral fire noodle challenges has painted a rather one-dimensional picture for many international diners.
Yeah, there is this assumption that to eat Korean food is to consume heavy animal fats heavily masked by capsaicin.
Qianggezhang Jjigae completely shatters that stereotype. It proves the foundation of the cuisine isn't just fire and meat. It is a profound historical mastery of biochemistry.
I love that. A mastery of biochemistry.
It showcases an ancient tradition of plant-based umami. The ability to take a handful of humble and expensive soybeans, harness a specific bacterial strain, and transform those beans into a hyper-efficient, profoundly savory stew base.
It's a testament to deep culinary engineering.
It is. It demonstrates that you do not need a slab of beef to command the center of the dining table.
Right.
The mastery of microbes provides all the luxury, depth, and satisfaction a diner could possibly want, and it does so in a fraction of the active cooking time.
It's basically a masterclass in culinary leverage. You aren't forcing the ingredients to paste good through hours of labor.
No, you're setting up the biological dominoes and letting the fermentation do the work for you.
It shifts the cook's role from a laborer to a conductor.
Culinary wisdom, meticulously preserved and distilled into a single boiling pot.
It really is. Well, we have covered some serious ground today, moving from the volatile, funky aromatics of rapid fermentation to the elegant 40-minute integration of a deeply savory vegetarian stew.
It's a journey.
We've navigated the pitfalls of commercial substitutes, uncovered the architectural brilliance of mild spice. But as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over in your own kitchen.
The broader implication of what we've unpacked today.
Exactly. It leaves you wondering about the future of global food systems. Right now, billions of dollars are being poured into modern laboratories, trying to genetically engineer plant-based proteins that can mimic the deep, satisfying, savory profile of meat.
Oh, absolutely.
We are desperately trying to invent highly efficient, sustainable ways to feed a growing planet without relying on the massive resources required for livestock. Yet, if a millennia-old technique using specific strains of bacillus can turn a handful of cheap soybeans into a hyper-efficient, umami-rich meat substitute in just 40 minutes.
It really makes you think.
What modern sustainability problems are we trying to solve in a lab today that traditional fermentation already solved centuries ago? Keep exploring, keep cooking, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.
This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.